Chapter 5. Renounce and Rejoice. Introduction. At the beginning of this chapter, the traditional approach to the spiritual life, that is, leaving the world, retiring from the ordinary affairs of job and family, is contrasted with working in the world with detachment. The general term for retiring from the world is sannyasa, renunciation. Traditionally, sannyasa meant renouncing all worldly ties and attachments. The person undertaking the vow of sannyasa would leave home, family, and occupation to pursue a strict contemplative life. This was a path chosen by very few, even in ancient India. Yet we shouldn't forget that surprising numbers of people in traditional societies, both in the East and the West, have chosen a monastic life, removed from the turmoil of the world. In India, the compassionate Buddha provides the classic example of one who leaves the comforts and fulfillments of family and worldly life to seek the lonely way to self-realization. The story is well known throughout Asia. Siddhartha Gautama was a prince with every worldly satisfaction within his reach, who left his palace to find a way to lead the world beyond suffering and death. He became a wandering sannyasi, a lonely, austere monk. Only after he had attained to complete enlightenment did he return to society to teach others of the peace of nirvana. Though Krishna acknowledges here that this way of sannyasa can lead to the goal, he recommends the path of selfless action, or selfless service, as the better way. He contrasts the way of sankhya, which in this context means knowledge of the self in a general way, to the way of yoga, which here means the way of action. This term yoga presents difficulties in the Gita, because it means different things at different times, and many definitions are given of this all-purpose term. But for several chapters, the topic under discussion has been the active spiritual life, or karma yoga. And that is clearly what is meant in this context. Sankhya and yoga might also be translated as theory and practice. It would seem that at the time of the Gita, the path of wisdom was regarded very highly, while the path of action may have been looked upon as an adulteration of the spiritual life. It is even possible that the Gita was the first Hindu scripture to introduce the novel idea of combining karma yoga with the pursuit of self-knowledge. Krishna says that only immature, inexperienced people look upon the paths of knowledge and action as different. The true goal of action is knowledge of the self. Following either path faithfully will lead to the complete spiritual vision. It is essential in karma yoga that the selfish ego not expect gratification from the work. When there is no selfish involvement in work, the worker does not come to spiritual harm. The example is the lotus. It spends its life floating in water, yet the drops of water roll off its leaves without ever wetting them. Similarly, as long as the karma yogis do not expect reward or recognition, any evil that might stain them has nowhere to cling. Such yogis are said to be detached from the outcome or fruits of their action. Karma pala. Krishna warns Arjuna that a life of work, even successful work, cannot be fulfilling without self-knowledge. Ultimately, the true self within him is not affected by what he does, whether good or bad. Only knowledge of the self, which rises like the sun at dawn, can fulfill the purpose of his life and lead him beyond rebirth. This knowledge of the self, or Atman, is by its very nature also knowledge of Brahman, the all-pervading, immanent and transcendent Godhead. Krishna says that the illumined person sees this divine essence in all beings. He or she has equal vision and sees the divine self in all, regardless of the outer aspect. The last three verses of the chapter describe a state of profound meditation called samadhi. When meditation becomes very deep, breathing becomes slow, steady, and even. and the windows of the senses close to all outward sensations. Next, the faculties of the mind quiet down, resting from their usual frantic activity. Even the primal emotions of desire, fear, and anger subside. When all these sensory and emotional tides have ceased to flow, then the spirit is free. Mukta, at least for the time being. It has entered the state called samadhi. Samadhi can come and go. Generally, it can be entered only in a long period of meditation and after many years of ardent endeavor. But one verse, chapter 5, verse 28, adds the significant word sadda, always. Once this state of deep concentration becomes established, the person lives in spiritual freedom, or moksha, permanently. This is extremely rare. Mystics of the West, as well as the East, have attained brief glimpses of unity. But very few can be said to have dwelt in it permanently, as if it were their natural habitat. In the West, the most prominent figures are Meister Eckhart, St. Teresa of Avila, and St. John of the Cross, though there have been others. In the Hindu tradition, there is a long line of saints and mystics who have tried to communicate something of the nature of this union with reality, or God. From the unknown recorders of the Upanishads, through the Buddha, Shankara, and Mira, to Ramakrishna and Ramana Maharshi. Chapter 5. Renounce and Rejoice. Arjuna. O Krishna, you have recommended both the path of selfless action and sannyasa, the path of renunciation of action. Tell me definitely which is better. Krishna. Both renunciation of action and the selfless performance of action lead to the supreme goal. But the path of action is better than renunciation. Those who have attained perfect renunciation are free from any sense of duality. They are unaffected by likes and dislikes, Arjuna, and are free from the bondage of self-will. The immature think that knowledge and action are different, but the wise see them as the same. The person who is established in one path will attain the rewards of both. The goal of knowledge and the goal of service are the same. Those who fail to see this are blind. Perfect renunciation is difficult to attain without performing action, but the wise, following the path of selfless service, quickly reach Brahman. Those who follow the path of service, who have completely purified themselves and conquered their senses and self-will, see the self in all creatures and are untouched by any action they perform. Those who know this truth, whose consciousness is unified, think always, I am not the doer. While seeing or hearing, touching or smelling, eating, moving about or sleeping, breathing or speaking, letting go or holding on, even opening or closing the eyes, they understand that these are only the movements of the senses among sense objects. Those who surrender to Brahmin all selfish attachments are like the leaf of a lotus floating clean and dry in the water. Sin cannot touch them. Renouncing their selfish attachments, those who follow the path of service work with body, senses, and mind for the sake of self-purification. Those whose consciousness is unified abandon all attachments to the results of action and attain supreme peace. But those whose desires are fragmented, who are selfishly attached to the results of their work, are bound in everything they do. Those who renounce attachment in all their deeds live content in the city of nine gates, the body, as its master. They are not driven to act, nor do they involve others in action. Neither the sense of acting, nor actions, nor the connection of cause and effect comes from the Lord of this world. These three arise from nature. The Lord does not partake in the good and evil deeds of any person. Judgment is clouded when wisdom is obscured by ignorance. But ignorance is destroyed by knowledge of the self within. The light of this knowledge shines like the sun, revealing the supreme Brahman. Those who cast off sin through this knowledge, absorbed in the Lord and established in Him as their one goal and refuge, are not reborn as separate creatures. Those who possess this wisdom have equal regard for all. They see the same self in a spiritual aspirant and an outcast, in an elephant, a cow, and a dog. Such people have mastered life. With even mind, they rest in Brahman, who is perfect and is everywhere the same. They are not elated by good fortune, nor depressed by bad. With mind established in Brahman, they are free from delusion. Not dependent on any external support, they realize the joy of spiritual awareness. With consciousness unified through meditation, they live in abiding joy. Pleasures conceived in the world of the senses have a beginning and an end, and give birth to misery, Arjuna. The wise do not look for happiness in them, but those who overcome the impulses of lust and anger which arise in the body are made whole and live in joy. They find their joy, their rest, and their light completely within themselves. United with the Lord, they attain nirvana in Brahman. Healed of their sins and conflicts, working for the good of all beings, the holy sages attain nirvana in Brahman. Free from anger and selfish desire, unified in mind, those who follow the path of yoga and realize the self are established forever in that supreme state. Closing their eyes, steadying their breathing, and focusing their attention on the center of spiritual consciousness, the wise master their senses, mind, and intellect through meditation. Self-realization is their only goal. Freed from selfish desire, fear, and anger, they live in freedom, always. Knowing me as the friend of all creatures, the Lord of the universe, the end of all offerings and all spiritual disciplines, they attain eternal peace. Chapter 6. The Practice of Meditation. Introduction. This is surely one of the most intriguing chapters of the Gita. For here we are given a detailed explanation of meditation addressed to the layperson. The same meditation techniques are given in more esoteric writings, such as the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. But the Gita does it more simply, without any unnecessary mystery or complexity. This chapter also explores the question, who is the true yogi? This word yogi may bring to mind images of amazing people who do strange contortions with their bodies. Yogis are still thought of as standing on their heads or reclining on a bed of nails. It is true that there are many practitioners of a kind of yoga that involves physical exercises and postures, and there are those who have achieved remarkable feats, like lying on beds of nails, or even being buried alive and surviving. But this physical side of yoga, called Hatha Yoga, the yoga of force, is not what is meant in the Gita. In fact, though physical techniques have a place, the Gita regards undue emphasis on them as outside the normal course of spiritual development. In the Gita, the word yogi often has a more modest definition. It can mean a person who does his or her job with detachment from the rewards, chapter 6, verse 1. Or it can be rendered as one who has attained the goal of meditation. For yogi literally means one who is accomplished in yoga. And yoga means integration of the spirit. In this sense, yoga means wholeness, or the process of becoming whole at the deepest spiritual level. The word yoga is often used as a synonym for Raja Yoga, the practice of meditation as taught by Patanjali. For meditation is the direct means of becoming integrated, united with one's truest, deepest self. Thus, a yogi, among other things, is a person who is an adept at meditation. Until now, Krishna has been instructing Arjuna in the need for karma yoga, the active life of service. Now, Krishna is ready to initiate him into the practice of the more interior disciplines of the spiritual life. Karma yoga, he says, is the path for those who wish to climb the mountain of self-realization. For those who have reached the summit, the path is shama, the peace of contemplation. At the beginning of the spiritual life, great exertion is required. As the summit is approached, though the climb gets no easier, the dimension of contemplation, or stillness, is added. Many spiritual traditions, of course, use this image when speaking of the religious quest. The mountaintop is the place where the holy, like Moses, commune with God. And St. John of the Cross speaks of climbing the mountain of Carmel. In climbing this mountain, willpower, self-help, and intense personal effort are absolute essentials. The literal translation of verse 5 is, one should lift oneself up by one's self, a play on the word Atman, which can mean the highest self, as well as self in the ordinary sense. One's self is thus one's friend or one's own enemy. The lower self is self-will, will in the negative, selfish sense. An unruly will, twisted towards self-aggrandizement, is an enemy lurking right inside the fort where it can do the most damage. But those who have conquered themselves by themselves have their truest friend in the self. Only those who have genuine self-discipline, who are self-conquered, live in peace. These, Krishna says, are true yogis. They cannot harbour any malice, cannot even bring themselves to look upon anyone as an enemy. They are sammabuddhi, of equable mind. The true yogis, who are fully integrated on all levels of consciousness, feel everyone's joy and sorrow just as if it were their own. They see the self in all beings, everywhere. How is this self-conquest to be made? Very simply, the Gita teaches that the mind must be made one-pointed through the practice of meditation. This is the basic technique. In the Gita, we do not see the tendency for elaboration, for ritual and mystery, that we sometimes find in the Hindu tradition. Krishna simply tells Arjuna first that he must find an appropriate place to meditate. A suitable spot for his practice will be clean and comfortable. In a nod to tradition, one verse recommends the meditation seat be covered with kusha grass and a deerskin, the traditional seat of the yogi. The important thing, however, is not how the meditation seat is made, but what is going on in the mind. Meditation is an internal discipline to make the mind one-pointed, absolutely concentrated. Second, Krishna instructs Arjuna to hold the body, head, and neck in a straight line. This may seem esoteric, a reference to the contortion school of yoga. But it has a practical purpose. Sitting absolutely straight, with the spinal column erect, prevents drowsiness. Also, in advanced stages of meditation, it allows for the free flow of vital energy, or kundalini. Then, practical advice is given. Moderation is the path. Neither extreme asceticism nor indulgence will aid meditation. An initial acquaintance with Hindu culture may give the impression that it fosters either the sensuality of the Kama Sutra or the asceticism of the hermit. It is true that in Indian civilization we can easily see the development of the sensual and artistic in many manifestations, in painting, sculpture, music, and dance. And Indian cuisine is famous for its variety of flavors and spices. India also presents us with the austere simplicity of the wandering holy man, or sadhu. The Gita, however, recommends the middle path. Success in meditation, Krishna says, comes neither to those who eat or sleep too much, nor to those who eat or sleep too little. The body should be neither overindulged nor treated harshly. The same recommendation the Buddha offers. This chapter contains the famous verse, chapter 6, verse 19, comparing the mind to a steady flame. By its very nature, the untrained mind is restless, constantly wandering here and there trying to fulfill its desires. It flickers wildly like a flame in a storm, never blown completely out, yet at the mercy of the wind. Wherever the mind wanders, Krishna says, it must be brought back to its source. It must learn to rest in the self. Once it is at home in the depths of contemplation, the mind becomes steady, like an upright, unflickering flame in a windless place. In this deep meditation, and only there, can the human being find true fulfillment. Then, the still mind touches Brahman and enjoys bliss. Now Arjuna asks an inevitable question. Krishna is far ahead of him, and the struggling disciple simply can't catch up. He says, "My mind is so restless and unsteady that I cannot even comprehend anything about this state of mystic peace you are talking about. The mind is so powerful, so turbulent, that trying to bring it under control is like trying to catch the wind." Krishna admits that the mind is terribly hard to train, but he maintains that it can be done through regular practice if one has detachment. It is interesting that he does not offer to help Arjuna here. That will come later. For now, he tells Arjuna that he must do it for himself, through hard work and detachment from private personal motives. Then Arjuna asks a rather surprising question. What happens to the person who believes in a spiritual goal, but does not pursue it to the end? What if one of his more powerful, compulsive desires gets the better of him, scattering his resolution the way a cloud is scattered by the wind? Either Arjuna is not prepared to seek self-realization, or he is afraid that somehow he might fail if he tried. If he were to fail, he asks, would he have lost everything, all that he had given up in worldly life, as well as his goal of self-fulfillment? Affectionately, Krishna assures Arjuna that no attempt to improve his spiritual condition could be a wasted effort. Even looking ahead to the next life, he has nothing to lose and everything to gain. He will be reborn in a household suitable for taking up his quest where he left off. In his next life, he will feel drawn to the spiritual goal once again, and he will have a head start. Chapter 6, The Practice of Meditation. Krishna, it is not those who lack energy or refrain from action, but those who work without expectation of reward who attain the goal of meditation. Theirs is true renunciation. Therefore, Arjuna, you should understand that renunciation and the performance of selfless service are the same. Those who cannot renounce attachment to the results of their work are far from the path. For aspirants who want to climb the mountain of spiritual awareness, the path is selfless work. For those who have ascended to yoga, the path is stillness and peace. When you have freed yourself from attachment to the results of work and from desires for the enjoyment of sense objects, you will ascend to the unitive state. Reshape yourself through the power of your will. Never let yourself be degraded by self-will. The will is the only friend of the self, and the will is the only enemy of the self. To those who have conquered themselves, the will is a friend, but it is the enemy of those who have not found the self within them. The supreme reality stands revealed in the consciousness of those who have conquered themselves. They live in peace, alike in cold and heat, pleasure and pain, praise and blame. They are completely fulfilled by spiritual wisdom and self-realization. Having conquered their senses, they have climbed to the summit of human consciousness. To such people, a clod of dirt, a stone, and gold are the same. They are equally disposed to family, enemies, and friends, to those who support them and those who are hostile, to the good and the evil alike. Because they are impartial, they rise to great heights. Those who aspire to the state of yoga should seek the self in inner solitude through meditation. With body and mind controlled, they should constantly practice one-pointedness, free from expectations and attachment to material possessions. Select a clean spot, neither too high nor too low, and seat yourself firmly on a cloth, a deerskin, and kusha grass. Then, once seated, strive to still your thoughts. Make your mind one-pointed in meditation, and your heart will be purified. Hold your body, head, and neck firmly in a straight line, and keep your eyes from wandering. With all fears dissolved in the peace of the self, and all actions dedicated to Brahman, controlling the mind and fixing it on me, sit in meditation with me as your only goal. With senses and mind constantly controlled through meditation, united with the self within, an aspirant attains nirvana, the state of abiding joy and peace in me. Arjuna, those who eat too much or eat too little, who sleep too much or sleep too little, will not succeed in meditation. But those who are temperate in eating and sleeping, work and recreation, will come to the end of sorrow through meditation. Through constant effort, they learn to withdraw the mind from selfish cravings and absorb it in the self. Thus, they attain the state of union. When meditation is mastered, the mind is unwavering, like the flame of a lamp in a windless place. In the still mind, in the depths of meditation, the self reveals itself. Beholding the self by means of the self, an aspirant knows the joy and peace of complete fulfillment. Having attained that abiding joy beyond the senses, revealed in the stilled mind, they never swerve from the eternal truth. They desire nothing else, and cannot be shaken by the heaviest burden of sorrow. The practice of meditation frees one from all affliction. This is the path of yoga. Follow it with determination and sustained enthusiasm. Renouncing wholeheartedly all selfish desires and expectations, use your will to control the senses. Little by little, through patience and repeated effort, the mind will become stilled in the self. Wherever the mind wanders, restless and diffuse in its search for satisfaction without, lead it within. Train it to rest in the self. Abiding joy comes to those who still the mind. Freeing themselves from the taint of self-will, with their consciousness unified, they become one with Brahman. The infinite joy of touching Brahman is easily attained by those who are free from the burden of evil and established within themselves. They see the self in every creature and all creation in the self. With consciousness unified through meditation, they see everything with an equal eye. I am ever present to those who have realized me in every creature. Seeing all life as my manifestation, they are never separated from me. They worship me in the hearts of all, and all their actions proceed from me. Wherever they may live, they abide in me. When a person responds to the joys and sorrows of others as if they were his own, he has attained the highest state of spiritual union. Arjuna, O Krishna, the stillness of divine union which you describe is beyond my comprehension. How can the mind which is so restless attain lasting peace? Krishna, the mind is restless, turbulent, powerful, violent. Trying to control it is like trying to tame the wind. Krishna, it is true that the mind is restless and difficult to control, but it can be conquered, Arjuna, through regular practice and detachment. Those who lack self-control will find it difficult to progress in meditation, but those who are self-controlled, striving earnestly through the right means, will attain the goal. Arjuna, Krishna, what happens to one who has faith, but who lacks self-control and wanders from the path, not attaining success in yoga? If he becomes deluded on the spiritual path, will he lose the support of both worlds, like a cloud scattered in the sky? Krishna, you can dispel all doubts. Remove this doubt which binds me. Krishna, Arjuna, my son, such a person will not be destroyed. No one who does good work will ever come to a bad end, either here or in the world to come. When such people die, they go to other realms where the righteous live. They dwell there for countless years and then are reborn into a home which is pure and prosperous. Or they may be born into a family where meditation is practiced. To be born into such a family is extremely rare. The wisdom they have acquired in previous lives will be reawakened, Arjuna, and they will strive even harder for self-realization. Indeed, they will be driven on by the strength of their past disciplines. Even one who inquires after the practice of meditation rises above those who simply perform rituals. Through constant effort over many lifetimes, a person becomes purified of all selfish desires and attains the supreme goal of life. Meditation is superior to severe asceticism and the path of knowledge. It is also superior to selfless service. May you attain the goal of meditation, Arjuna. Even among those who meditate, that man or woman who worships me with perfect faith, completely absorbed in me, is the most firmly established in yoga. Chapter 7. Wisdom from Realization. Introduction. In Sanskrit, this chapter is called The Yoga of Wisdom and Realization, or The Yoga of Wisdom from Realization. The term used for wisdom is jnana. For realization, vijnana. There is room for confusion in this terminology, as jnana and vijnana are open to differing interpretations. Both words are from the root jna, to know, which is related to the Greek word gnosis. The prefix vi added to a noun usually intensifies its meaning. So vijnana could mean to know intensely or to a greater degree. In this context, however, jnana is the standard term for the highest kind of knowledge. Not scholarship or book learning, but direct knowledge of God, spiritual wisdom. If we take jnana in this sense, we are not left with an obvious meaning for vijnana, a more intense kind of jnana. Ramakrishna takes vijnana to mean an intimate, practical familiarity with God, the ability to carry through in daily affairs with the more abstract understanding that is jnana. Ramakrishna says, "One who has merely heard of fire has ajnana, ignorance. One who has seen fire has jnana, but one who has actually built a fire and cooked on it has vijnana." In this chapter, we find ourselves following several trails and sometimes lose the unifying theme, which is knowledge of the supreme reality underlying nature. Eventually, however, we come back to the starting point. Knowledge contrasted with ignorance, transcendent reality as opposed to the phenomenal world. But to pursue the byways, first, Krishna's two natures are discussed. On the one hand, he has created out of himself the elements and all things that make up the phenomenal world. Beyond this is Krishna's spiritual nature as the transcendent Lord of the universe. Here the Gita is referring to a concept that later became a basis of the Sankhya school of Hindu philosophy. Sankhya recognized two fundamental principles underlying all things. Prakriti, the principle of mind and matter, and Purusha, the principle of pure spirit. The union of these two eternal fundamental forces sets in motion the creation of the world as we know it. Their union also shapes and defines all ordinary human experience. In Sankhya, the goal of self-realization is seen as the final freeing of the spirit, Purusha, from its flirtation with mind and matter, Prakriti. Unlike Sankhya, however, in the Gita, it is Krishna who is behind both Prakriti and Purusha. In this chapter, Krishna is presented as the creator of the world. His divine nature can be glimpsed in his bewildering and wonderful creation. In much Hindu mythology, it is the god Brahma who takes credit for creating the world. It is he, the four-faced deity, who has flung forth the manifold worlds of this and former, as well as future, universes. But in the mythology of Vishnu, Brahma is born in the lotus that grows from Vishnu's navel. The lotus is Vishnu's womb. In it, Brahma is born, and at Vishnu's urging, he creates the worlds. Vishnu is the real creator. Brahma is a demigod born of Vishnu's will to create. Here in the Gita, Krishna directly assumes all the roles and honors usually shared with the other aspects of God worshipped in the Hindu faith. It is not that these other divine personifications are rejected, but simply that all attention is on Krishna. For the author of the Gita, Krishna is the form of God to be worshipped, and for the time being all other forms of God disappear. Krishna alone is. In fact, one verse states that whatever other god one seems to worship, one is in reality approaching Krishna himself. Worshipping him, knowing him, enables the devotee to attain the goal. Though the word is not used in the Gita, the idea of the world as Krishna's lila, his play, became a cherished theme of later Hinduism. Krishna, it is said, created the world in play. Just as a child might desire to have companions to play with, Krishna desired companions and made the world. Krishna participates in the game of life. His divine qualities shine through in the world wherever there is excellence of any kind. He is, he tells Arjuna, the essence of every created thing. The sapidity of water, the brightness of fire, the effort of the spiritual aspirant. This may be what is meant by the vijnana of our title. The mystic's vision of the divine as present here and now is perhaps the real meaning of the term. The word maya appears here, though not for the first time in the Gita. Just as the concepts of Prakriti and Purusha are later developed in Sankhya philosophy, Maya is later built into the formal structure of Vedanta, another of the six major schools of Indian philosophy. The word Maya comes from the root ma, to measure out, and originally meant the power of a deity to create, especially to create what Indian philosophy calls name and form, matter and its percepts. Maya was the magical capacity to create form and illusion, a god's divine power to put on a disguise, or to fling forth world after world of life. Maya is also the outward look of things, the passing show that conceals immortal being. Maya can be both delightful and dangerous, alluring and yet treacherous. The gunas, the three basic qualities of all created things, swirl within the world of Maya. Crossing over the ocean of Maya is the goal of the wise voyager, and one boat is devotion. In this chapter, the Gita begins to stress the importance of love and devotion, themes that later become dominant. Krishna's true nature is hidden by Maya, chapter 7, verse 25. The dangers of Maya are not depicted strongly in this chapter, but the delusions, moha, of life in Maya's world are hinted at. They are essentially the self-centered attachments Krishna has been warning us against. Moha, which means confusion or delusion, is something like dreaming while awake, living in a dream. The duality of attachment and aversion, love and hate, beguiles the mind into this moha swoon right at birth, chapter 7, verse 27. Knowing Krishna and devotion to him is the way beyond this delusion. Thus, chapter 7 contrasts wisdom, jnana and vijnana, with the delusion, moha, of spiritual ignorance. We find here many seminal ideas that are elaborated in the later philosophies of Sankhya and Vedanta. These concepts of Prakriti, Purusha and Maya do not originate with the Gita, however. The word Maya appears in the Rig Veda, the most ancient of the Vedas, and Purusha is a recurring theme in the Upanishads. The Gita is a halfway point between the spontaneous insights of the Upanishads and the later highly formalized philosophical systems. In the Gita, we find an organized presentation of these and other key concepts without a cumbersome technical explanation. Chapter 7. Wisdom from Realization. Krishna. With your mind intent on me, Arjuna, discipline yourself with the practice of yoga. Depend on me completely. Listen, and I will dispel all your doubts. You will come to know me fully and be united with me. I will give you both jnana and vijnana. When both these are realized, there's nothing more you need to know. One person in many thousands may seek perfection, yet of these, only a few reach the goal and come to realize me. Earth, water, fire, air, akasha, mind, intellect, and ego. These are the eight divisions of my Prakriti. But beyond this, I have another higher nature, Arjuna. It supports the whole universe and is the source of life in all beings. In these two aspects of my nature is the womb of all creation. The birth and dissolution of the cosmos itself takes place in me. There is nothing that exists separate from me, Arjuna. The entire universe is suspended from me as my necklace of jewels. Arjuna, I am the taste of pure water and the radiance of the sun and moon. I am the sacred word and the sound heard in air, and the courage of human beings. I am the sweet fragrance in the earth, and the radiance of fire. I am the life in every creature, and the striving of the spiritual aspirant. My eternal seed, Arjuna, is to be found in every creature. I am the power of discrimination in those who are intelligent, and the glory of the noble. In those who are strong, I am strength, free from passion and selfish attachment. I am desire itself, if that desire is in harmony with the purpose of life. The states of sattva, rajas, and tamas come from me, but I am not in them. These three gunas deceive the world. People fail to look beyond them to me, supreme and imperishable. The three gunas make up my divine maya, difficult to overcome. But they cross over this maya who take refuge in me. Others are deluded by maya, performing evil deeds. They have no devotion to me. Having lost all discrimination, they follow the way of their lower nature. Good people come to worship me for different reasons. Some come to the spiritual life because of suffering. Some in order to understand life. Some come through a desire to achieve life's purpose. And some come who are men and women of wisdom, unwavering in devotion, always united with me. The man or woman of wisdom surpasses all the others. To them I am the dearest beloved, and they are very dear to me. All those who follow the spiritual path are blessed, but the wise, who are always established in union, for whom there is no higher goal than me, may be regarded as my very self. After many births, the wise seek refuge in me, seeing me everywhere and in everything. Such great souls are very rare. There are others whose discrimination is misled by many desires. Following their own nature, they worship lower gods, practicing various rites. When a person is devoted to something with complete faith, I unify his faith in that. Then, when faith is completely unified, one gains the object of devotion. In this way, every desire is fulfilled by me. Those whose understanding is small attain only transient satisfaction. Those who worship the gods go to the gods. But my devotees come to me. Through lack of understanding, people believe that I, the unmanifest, have entered into some form. They fail to realize my true nature, which transcends birth and death. Few see through the veil of maya. The world, deluded, does not know that I am without birth and changeless. I know everything about the past, the present, and the future, Arjuna. But there is no one who knows me completely. Delusion arises from the duality of attraction and aversion, Arjuna. Every creature is deluded by these from birth. But those who have freed themselves from all wrongdoing are firmly established in worship of me. Their actions are pure, and they are free from the delusion caused by the pairs of opposites. Those who take refuge in me, striving for liberation from old age and death, come to know Brahman, the self, and the nature of all action. Those who see me ruling the cosmos, who see me in the Adibhuta, the Adidaiva, and the Adiyajna, are conscious of me even at the time of death. Chapter 8. The Eternal Godhead. Introduction. This chapter alludes briefly to several important concepts presented more fully in the Upanishads, and it will be helpful to quote the Upanishads to elucidate these points. Also, this chapter presents a very ancient view of the soul's journey after death. These ideas about the afterlife did not originate in the Gita, and are even more ancient than the Upanishads. Another ancient concept here is that of a cyclical universe, which is elaborated in other Hindu scriptures in great detail. This chapter merely refers to it in passing. The chapter begins with Arjuna asking what appear to be questions of theology, but the role of theologian does not fit him naturally. These questions are asked in response to the technical terms mentioned in the last verse of chapter 7. The sense of Krishna's answer is in accord with what he said earlier about his Maya. He is God immanent in all things, as well as God transcendent. But it is Arjuna's other question that determines the direction the discourse now takes. Arjuna asks how Krishna can be known at the hour of death. Here, of course, Arjuna means Krishna in his cosmic, mystical aspect. So he is asking, in essence, how can the self-realized person enter the supreme state of immortality at the time of death? Krishna replies that whoever remembers him at the time of death will enter Madbhavam, my being. If Arjuna can remember Krishna in the hour of death, he will be united with Krishna and enter into immortality. In fact, whatever it may be, the content of the mind at the hour of death directs the soul on its journey to rebirth. Thus, the mind influences the evolution of the soul as it moves into the next life. Whatever a person thinks about in life, his or her deepest motivations, are likely to be the last thoughts at the time of death. So there is a continuity between this life and the next, and all the baggage of desire and motivation goes right along with the soul. But here, Krishna is talking about the person, he hopes Arjuna will be such a one, who has no worldly baggage, who will remember Krishna at the final hour. To ensure he will focus his devotion on Krishna at the hour of death, Arjuna should make a practice of remembering him continually now. If he makes his mind one-pointed in meditation and learns to focus his being on Krishna, then naturally at the time of death he will think of nothing else. Otherwise, in the chaos of death, he will panic and lose his way. Krishna describes in detail what happens to consciousness at the moment of death, chapter 8, verses 12 and 13. These verses actually describe the yogis as being in control of the process of death, directing their consciousness step by step through the difficult ordeal of leaving the body. They attain the supreme goal. This idea is also accepted by one of the greatest teachers of meditation in ancient India, Patanjali, who says in the Yoga Sutras that the yogi dies at will. Similar descriptions of the death process occur in the Upanishads, though there the dying person is not necessarily in control. The Upanishads give a detailed account. When the self seems to become weak and sink into unconsciousness, the vital breaths gather to him. Then he takes with him those particles of light and descends into the heart. When the consciousness that is in the eye turns back, the dying person no longer sees any form. He is becoming one, they say. He does not see. He is becoming one, they say. He does not smell. He is becoming one, they say. He does not taste. He is becoming one, they say. He does not speak. He is becoming one, they say. He does not hear. He is becoming one, they say. He does not think, or touch, or know. The point of his heart lights up, and by that light, the self departs, either through the eye, or the skull, or through some other door of the body. And when he departs, life departs. And when life departs, all other vital forces depart after it. He is conscious, and with consciousness he leaves the body. Then his knowledge and his works and his previous impressions go along with him. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Chapter 4, Verses 1 and 2. First, consciousness is withdrawn from the senses. The dying no longer hear or see what is going on around them. They are still conscious, but the light of consciousness has been withdrawn from the senses, here called the gates of the body. There are said to be 9 such gates: 2 eyes, 2 nostrils, 2 ears, the mouth, and the organs of generation and excretion. Sometimes 2 more are added: the navel and the sagittal suture, located at the top of the skull and called in Sanskrit Brahmarandra, the aperture of Brahman. When consciousness has been withdrawn from these gates, Krishna says, the mind is placed, locked up, in the heart. Chapter 8, verse 12. Here, as in Christian mysticism, it is the heart and not the head that is taken to be the home of the soul. Probably what is meant is the heart chakra, the center of consciousness corresponding to the center of the chest. Prana, vital energy, and awareness have been withdrawn from the outer frontiers of personality and consolidated within. At this stage of the death process, an ordinary person has no access to the will, but it is just here that prana, with conscious awareness, must be made to move upwards to the head. If prana leaves the body through the Brahmarandra, there will be no rebirth. That is, the dying person will enter samadhi at the time of death. In samadhi, prana is withdrawn from lower levels of awareness to rush upwards to the 7th center at the crown of the head. This is possible only for the yogi who has thoroughly mastered meditation and the control of prana. If prana exits through some other one of the 11 doors of the body, the Upanishads say the state of immortality will not be gained. When he departs from this body, he ascends with the rays of the sun, repeating the syllable Om. As soon as he thinks of it, he comes to the sun. That indeed is the door to the next world. Those who know enter. Those who do not know are stopped. There is a verse, 101 subtle tracks lead from the heart. One of these goes upwards to the crown of the head. Going up by it, he goes to eternal life. Others depart in various directions. The Chandogya Upanishad, Chapter 8, Part 6, Verses 5 and 6. In the Gita, as well as in this passage from the Chandogya Upanishad, the mantram Om is used. If the yogis can remember the mantram even as consciousness itself is departing the body, and the Gita adds, if they can meditate on Krishna, they will go to the highest goal. Relinquishing the body in a state of samadhi, they attain the mystic eternity that is union with Krishna. In this chapter, the Gita alludes to the 2 paths, northern and southern, that the soul may take after death. Verses 24 to 25 present in abbreviated form what the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad spells out in obscure detail. Those who know this, who meditate upon truth with faith while living in the forest, go to the light, from light to day, from day to the fortnight of the moon's waxing, from the waxing fortnight to the 6 months of the sun's northern journey, from those 6 months to the world of the devas, from the world of the devas to the sun, from the sun to the lightning. Then a spirit approaches them and leads them to the world of Brahman. In that world they live for eternal ages. They do not return again. But those who conquer worlds through sacrifice, charity, and austerity pass into the smoke, from the smoke into the night, from the night into the fortnight of the waning moon, from the fortnight of the waning moon into the 6 months of the sun's southern journey, from there into the world of the ancestors, from the world of the ancestors into the moon, and from there to rebirth. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Chapter 6, part 2, verses 15 to 16. Northern and southern parts refer to the path of the sun, which seems to move northward after the winter solstice and southward after the summer solstice. To die during the period in which the sun is moving southward was considered inauspicious. Dying during the period after the winter solstice, when the sun is moving back north, meant the soul might take the northern path, which leads to immortality. In the Gita and the Upanishads, this northern path has come to signify that the soul has been released from karma and need not be reborn. The southern path, by contrast, leads the soul to a new birth in this world, a birth suitable to its karma. This view of the soul's journey after death has a primordial quality about it, giving the feeling that it far predates even the Upanishads. Perhaps it is a belief of very ancient times that found its way into the Upanishads, which say that the spiritually ready soul makes the journey of the northern route, while those who have only practiced rituals take the southern. This chapter also briefly alludes to the days and nights of Brahma. Brahma is the creator of the Hindu Trinity, who brings forth the cosmos at the will of Vishnu. But Brahma, in a sense, is not in control of this creative process. Just as day follows night, in eternal, unwavering rhythm, so does the entire universe undergo cycles of creation, death, and new birth. As the day of Brahma dawns, the cosmos comes into being. As the day comes to an end, the entire creation dies and ceases to exist. Then, for a night as long as the cosmic day, the universe rests. It ceases to be, or rather, it continues only in a subtle, unmanifest form, a dream in the mind of Vishnu, who lies sleeping on the waves of the cosmic ocean. Then, without deviating from the eternal rhythm, the cosmos is reborn when the night is over. The new universe dawns, and Brahma once again moves into his active, creative day. Scholars have noted that this grand vision of the cosmos being born, dying, and being reborn for eternity, cosmos after cosmos arising from the black immensity of nothingness, is quite similar to modern theories of the expanding and contracting universe put forward by contemporary cosmology. The vast time spans accepted by present-day physics are also similar to the cosmic days and nights of Brahma. Each day lasts for 1,000 yugas, which equals 4,320,000,000 years. For this near eternity of time, the universe lives and grows. Then it dies and lies dormant for an equal time before the new day dawns. There is a state of being, however, that is higher than the perishable cosmos, which is not born and does not die the cosmic death. Here, chapter 8, verse 20, it is simply called Avyakta, the unmanifest. This is the supreme goal of all living things, and it is Krishna's home. Chapter 8, verse 21. Returning to this final resting place, the soul enters into immortal bliss and is not reborn. Chapter 8, The Eternal Godhead. Arjuna. O Krishna, what is Brahman? And what is the nature of action? What is the Adiyatma, the Adibhuta, and the Adidaiva? What is the Adiyajna, the supreme sacrifice? And how is it to be offered? How are the self-controlled united with you at the time of death? Krishna, my highest nature, the imperishable Brahman, gives every creature its existence, and lives in every creature as Adiyatma. My action is creation and the bringing forth of creatures. The Adibhuta is the perishable body. The Adidaiva is Purusha, eternal spirit. the Adiyajna, the supreme sacrifice, is made to me as the Lord within you. Those who remember me at the time of death will come to me. Do not doubt this. Whatever occupies the mind at the time of death determines the destination of the dying. Always they will tend toward that state of being. Therefore, remember me at all times and fight on. With your heart and mind intent on me, you will surely come to me. When you make your mind one-pointed through regular practice of meditation, you will find the supreme glory of the Lord. The Lord is the supreme poet, the first cause, the sovereign ruler, subtler than the tiniest particle, the support of all. Inconceivable, bright as the sun, beyond darkness. Remembering him in this way at the time of death, through devotion and the power of meditation, with your mind completely stilled and your concentration fixed in the center of spiritual awareness between the eyebrows, you will realize the Supreme Lord. I will tell you briefly of the eternal state all scriptures affirm, which can be entered only by those who are self-controlled and free from selfish passions. Those whose lives are dedicated to Brahman attain this supreme goal. Remembering me at the time of death, close down the doors of the senses and place the mind in the heart. Then, while absorbed in meditation, focus all energy upwards to the head. Repeating in this state the divine name, the syllable Om, that represents the changeless Brahman, you will go forth from the body and attain the supreme goal. I am easily attained by the person who always remembers me and is attached to nothing else. Such a person is a true yogi, Arjuna. Great souls make their lives perfect and discover me. They are freed from mortality and the suffering of this separate existence. Every creature in the universe is subject to rebirth, Arjuna, except the one who is united with me. Those who understand the cosmic laws know that the day of Brahma ends after 1,000 yugas, and the night of Brahma ends after 1,000 yugas. When the day of Brahma dawns, forms are brought forth from the unmanifest. When the night of Brahma comes, these forms merge in the formless again. This multitude of beings is created and destroyed again and again in the succeeding days and nights of Brahma. But beyond this formless state, there is another, unmanifested reality, which is eternal and is not dissolved when the cosmos is destroyed. Those who realize life's supreme goal know that I am unmanifested and unchanging. Having come home to me, they never return to separate existence. This Supreme Lord, who pervades all existence, the true self of all creatures, may be realized through undivided love. There are two paths, Arjuna, which the soul may follow at the time of death. One leads to rebirth, and the other to liberation. The 6 months of the northern path of the sun, the path of light, of fire, of day, of the bright fortnight, leads knowers of Brahman to the supreme goal. The 6 months of the southern path of the sun, the path of smoke, of night, of the dark fortnight, leads other souls to the light of the moon and to rebirth. These two paths, the light and the dark, are said to be eternal, leading some to liberation and others to rebirth. Once you have known these two paths, Arjuna, you can never be deluded again. Attain this knowledge through perseverance in yoga. There is merit in studying the scriptures, in selfless service, austerity, and giving. But the practice of meditation carries you beyond all these to the supreme abode of the highest Lord. Chapter 9, The Royal Path. Introduction. This chapter praises Krishna as the Supreme Being, who has created the world and dwells immanent in his creation. Krishna's exalted nature is stressed, and warning is given to those who think that God is limited to his creation. It is true that Krishna has taken on a human form, but those who see only a limited human being and show him disrespect are caught in great spiritual harm. These verses contain a warning for those who would underestimate Krishna's divine power. In this chapter, Krishna replaces the many gods and goddesses of the usual Hindu pantheon, each of which represents a different divine power. Here, Krishna is seen as containing within himself all such powers. It is Krishna and Krishna alone who is to be worshipped. He is the goal, the support, the only refuge, the one true friend. He is the beginning and the end. Chapter 9, verse 18. It follows that those who practice a ritual religion, offering the ritual sacrifices ordained by the Vedas, do not attain the true goal of their lives. True, they do enjoy heaven after death, but when their store of merit is used up, they are born again, in order to have another chance at turning away from personal gain and aiming at life's supreme goal. So long as they are motivated only by self-centered desires, they must be born again and again, and their spiritual evolution either stands still or they make very little progress. Even these souls, however, are really worshipping Krishna, though they do not know it. They seek Krishna, the Supreme Being, in all their wanderings through many, many lives, and even in their sojourns in heaven, where they enjoy the reward of their good deeds. Because they do not know his real nature, however, they will not attain the goal, but will be reborn. An endless round of rebirths may seem like a living damnation of the struggling soul, a harsh note that would be uncharacteristic of the Gita. But this is not a question of damnation. The purpose of life is to realize God, and until this is done, the soul cannot escape creating more karma, which has to be worked out, however many lives it may take. The choice to turn towards self-realization is always open. The Gita does not dwell on the obstacles, however, but quickly goes on to reveal Krishna's more compassionate nature. It makes the point that whatever a person deeply desires, whatever he or she worships, will eventually be attained in some life or other. In particular, to have real, selfless love, regardless of the object, is to love Krishna, the ultimate good. This kind of love, called bhakti, is far more potent than observances and rituals, a point the Gita is slowly revealing. But to have this devotion without understanding Krishna's nature is not enough. In the end, to attain his goal, Arjuna must have devotion and understand it is Krishna's universal aspect that he loves. Then he will truly attain the eternal, immortal state. This chapter contains a famous and very popular series of verses. Whatever you do, make it an offering to me. The food you eat, the sacrifices you make, the help you give, even your suffering. In this way, you will be freed from the bondage of karma and from its results, both pleasant and painful. Chapter 9, verses 27 and 28. Krishna accepts every offering to him in the right spirit. He assures Arjuna of this. Then he demands that Arjuna make everything, every act, every meal, every sacrifice, every gift, even his sufferings, an offering to God. He demands this so that Arjuna can be released from the bondage of karma. This is a new emphasis, a new way. If Arjuna can live in complete union with Krishna's will, doing everything for Krishna alone, then, by that very purity of will, he will be free from selfish motives and thus released from karma. His spirit will be free, and he will attain his goal of mystic union with Krishna. Krishna declares that he is impartial to all creatures. He neither favors nor rejects anyone. It is their sincere love that is important. Those who are truly devoted to Krishna live in him, and he abides in them. With some daring, probably at the risk of discomfort to the more orthodox, Krishna adds that even a sinner who takes wholehearted refuge in him becomes good. The word used is sadhu, which literally means a good person, but has come to signify one who leads the spiritual life, giving up all selfish desires to achieve the final goal. The word for sinner, sudurachara, should not be passed by either. Su is literally good. Dur is bad. Thus, one whose conduct is really bad, as we might say good and hot to mean really hot. Krishna promises that his devotees must attain peace at last. No one who has genuine love and devotion can perish. The meaning here is taken to be perish in a spiritual sense, come to spiritual harm. The message of this chapter is simple. It contains no philosophy and only a little theology. The one message is, anyone who has real love, love for the Lord of love, who is in all creatures, will in the end attain the goal. This is the royal secret that Krishna has promised to reveal. Chapter 9. The Royal Path. Krishna. Because of your faith, I shall tell you the most profound of secrets. Obtaining both jnana and vijnana, you will be free from all evil. This royal knowledge, this royal secret, is the greatest purifier. Righteous and imperishable, it is a joy to practice and can be directly experienced. But those who have no faith in the supreme law of life do not find me, Arjuna. They return to the world, passing from death to death. I pervade the entire universe in my unmanifested form. All creatures find their existence in me, but I am not limited by them. Behold, my divine mystery. These creatures do not really dwell in me, and though I bring them forth and support them, I am not confined within them. They move in me as the winds move in every direction in space. At the end of the aeon, these creatures return to unmanifested matter. At the beginning of the next cycle, I send them forth again. Controlling my prakriti again and again, I bring forth these myriad forms and subject them to the laws of prakriti. None of these actions binds me, Arjuna. I am unattached to them, so they do not disturb my nature. Under my watchful eye, the laws of nature take their course. Thus is the world set in motion. Thus the animate and the inanimate are created. The immature do not look beyond physical appearances to see my true nature as the Lord of all creation. The knowledge of such deluded people is empty. Their lives are fraught with disaster and evil, and their work and hopes are all in vain. But truly great souls seek my divine nature. They worship me with a one-pointed mind, having realized that I am the eternal source of all. Constantly striving, they make firm their resolve and worship me without wavering. Full of devotion, they sing of my divine glory. Others follow the path of jnana, spiritual wisdom. They see that where there is one, that one is me. Where there are many, all are me. They see my face everywhere. I am the ritual and the sacrifice. I am true medicine and the mantram. I am the offering and the fire which consumes it, and the one to whom it is offered. I am the father and mother of this universe, and its grandfather too. I am its entire support. I am the sum of all knowledge, the purifier, the syllable Om. I am the sacred scriptures, the Rig, Yajur, and Samavedas. I am the goal of life, the Lord and support of all, the inner witness, the abode of all. I am the only refuge, the one true friend. I am the beginning, the staying, and the end of creation. I am the womb and the eternal seed. I am heat. I give and withhold the rain. I am immortality, and I am death. I am what is and what is not. Those who follow the rituals given in the Vedas, who offer sacrifices and take soma, free themselves from evil and attain the vast heaven of the gods, where they enjoy celestial pleasures. When they have enjoyed these fully, their merit is exhausted, and they return to this land of death. Thus, observing Vedic rituals but caught in an endless chain of desires, they come and go. Those who worship me and meditate on me constantly without any other thought, I will provide for all their needs. Those who worship other gods with faith and devotion also worship me, Arjuna, even if they do not observe the usual forms. I am the object of all worship, its enjoyer and Lord. But those who fail to realize my true nature must be reborn. Those who worship the Devas will go to the realm of the Devas. Those who worship their ancestors will be united with them after death. Those who worship phantoms will become phantoms. But my devotees will come to me. Whatever I am offered in devotion with a pure heart, a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I accept with joy. Whatever you do, make it an offering to me. The food you eat, the sacrifices you make, the help you give, even your suffering. In this way, you will be freed from the bondage of karma and from its results, both pleasant and painful. Then, firm in renunciation and yoga, with your heart free, you will come to me. I look upon all creatures equally. None are less dear to me, and none more dear. But those who worship me with love live in me, and I come to life in them. Even sinners become holy when they take refuge in me alone. Quickly their souls conform to Dharma, and they attain to boundless peace. Never forget this, Arjuna. No one who is devoted to me will ever come to harm. All those who take refuge in me, whatever their birth, race, sex, or caste, will attain the supreme goal. This realization can be attained even by those whom society scorns. Kings and sages, too, seek this goal with devotion. Therefore, having been born in this transient and forlorn world, give all your love to me. Fill your mind with me. Love me. Serve me. Worship me always. Seeking me in your heart, you will at last be united with me.